Chapter 9. Life in the Clearings versus the Bush by Susanna Moody. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Odd Characters.
Dear merry reader, did you ever hear, whilst travelling on the world's wide beaten road, the curious reasoning and opinions queer of men who never in their lives bestowed 1 hour on study, whose existence seems a thing of course, a practical delusion, a day of frowning clouds and sunny gleams, of pain and pleasure, mixed in strange confusion, who feel they move and breathe, they know not why, are born to eat and drink, and sleep and die?
The shores of the Prince Edward District become more bold and beautiful as the steamer pursues her course up the long reach. Magnificent trees clothe these rugged banks to their very summits, and cast dense shadows upon the waters that slumber at their feet. The slanting rays of the evening sun stream through their thick foliage, and weave a network of gold around the corrugated trunks of the huge oak and maple trees that tower far above our heads. The glorious waters are dyed with a thousand changeful hues of crimson and saffron, and reflect from their unruffled surface the gorgeous tints of a Canadian sunset. The pines, with their hearse-like plumes, loom out darkly against the glowing evening sky, and frown austerely upon us, their gloomy aspect affording a striking contrast to the sun-lighted leaves of the feathery birch and the rock elm. It is a lonely hour, and one that nature seems to have set apart for prayer and praise. A devotional spirit seems to breathe over the earth, the woods, and waters, softening and harmonizing the whole into one blessed picture of love and peace. The boat has again crossed the bay, and stops to take in wood at Robin's Wharf. We are now beneath the shadow of the Indian Woods, a reserve belonging to the Mohawks in the township of Thayendanegea, about 24 miles by water from Belleville. A broad belt of forest land forms the background to a cleared slope, rising gradually from the water until it reaches a considerable elevation above the shore. The frontage to the bay is filled up with neat farmhouses and patches of buckwheat and Indian corn, the only grain that remains unharvested at this season of the year. We have a fine view of the stone church built by the Indians, which stands on the top of the hill, about a mile from the water. Queen Anne presented to this tribe 3 large marble tablets engraved with the 10 Commandments, which, after following them in all their ramblings for a century and a half, now grace the altar of this church, and are regarded with great veneration by the Indian settlers, who seem to look upon them with a superstitious awe. The church is built in a Gothic style, and is one of the most picturesque village churches that I have seen in Canada. The Indians contributed a great part of the funds for erecting this building. I was never within the walls of the sacred edifice, but I have wandered round the quiet, peaceful burial ground, and admired the lovely prospect it commands of the bay and the opposite shores. One side of the churchyard is skirted by a natural grove of forest trees, which separates it from the parsonage, a neat white building that fronts the water and stands back from it at the head of a noble sweep of land covered with velvet turf, and resembling greatly a gentleman's park at home, by the fine groups of stately forest trees scattered over it, and a semicircular belt of the original forest that, sloping from the house on either side, extends its wings until it meets the blue waters of the bay, leaving between its green arms a broad space of cleared land. The first time my eyes ever rested on this beautiful spot, it appeared to me a perfect paradise. It was a warm, balmy moonlight evening in June. The rich, resinous odor of the woods filled the air with delicious perfume. Fireflies were glancing like shooting stars among the dark foliage that hung over the water, and the spirit of love and peace sat brooding over the luxurious solitude, whose very silence was eloquent with praise of the great Maker. How I envied the residents of the parsonage their lovely home, How disappointed I felt when Mrs. G. told me that she felt it dull and lonely, that she was out of society, and that the Indians were very troublesome neighbors. Now, I have no doubt that this was all very true, and that I should have felt the same want that she did after the bewitching novelty of the scene had become familiar, but it sadly destroyed the romance and poetry of it to me at the time. This part of the township of Thayendanegea belongs almost exclusively to the Mohawk Indians, who have made a large settlement here, while the government has given them a good school for instructing their children in the Indian and English languages, and they have a resident clergyman of the establishment always at hand to minister to them the spiritual consolations of religion and impart to them the blessed truths of the gospel. The Reverend S. G. was for some years the occupant of the pretty parsonage house, and was greatly beloved by his Indian congregation. The native residents of these woods clear farms and build and plant like their white neighbors. They rear horses, cattle, and sheep, and sow a sufficient quantity of grain to secure them from want. But there is a great lack of order and regularity in all their agricultural proceedings. They do not make half as much out of their lands, which they suffer to be overgrown with thorns and thistles, as their white neighbors, and their domestic arrangements within doors are never marked by that appearance of comfort and cleanliness which is to be seen in the dwellings of the native Canadian and emigrants from Europe. The red man is out of his element when he settles quietly down to a farm, and you perceive it at a glance. He never appears to advantage as a resident among civilized men, and he seems painfully conscious of his inferiority and ignorance of the arts of life. He has lost his identity, as it were, and when he attempts to imitate the customs and manners of the whites, he is too apt to adopt their vices without acquiring their industry and perseverance, and sinks into a sottish, degraded savage. The proud independence we admired so much in the man of the woods has disappeared with his truthfulness, honesty, and simple manners. His pure blood is tainted with the dregs of a lower humanity, degenerated by the want and misery of overpopulous European cities. His light eyes, crisp hair, and whitey-brown complexion too surely betray his mixed origin, and we turn from the half-educated, half-caste Indian with feelings of aversion and mistrust. There is a Mohawk family who reside in the township of the name of Loft, who have gained some celebrity in the colony by their clever representations of the manner and customs of their tribe. They sing Indian songs, dance the war dance, hold councils, and make grave speeches in the characters of Indian chiefs and hunters, in an artistic manner that would gain the applause of a more fastidious audience. The two young squaws, who were the principal performers in this traveling Indian opera, were the most beautiful Indian women I ever beheld. There was no base alloy in their pure native blood. They had the large, dark, humid eyes, the ebon locks tinged with purple, so peculiar to their race, and which gives such a rich tint to the clear olive skin and brilliant white teeth of the denizens of the Canadian wilderness. Susanna Loft and her sister were the beau ideal of Indian women, and their graceful and symmetrical figures were set off to great advantage by their picturesque and becoming costume, which in their case was composed of the richest materials. Their acting and carriage were dignified and queen-like, and their appearance singularly pleasing and interesting. Susanna, the eldest, and certainly the most graceful of these truly fascinating girls, was unfortunately killed last summer by the collision of two steam carriages while traveling professionally with her sister through the States. Those who had listened with charmed ears to her sweet voice and gazed with admiring eyes upon her personal charms were greatly shocked at her untimely death. A little boy and girl belonging to the same talented family have been brought before the public in order to supply her place, but they have not been able to fill up the blank occasioned by her loss. The steamboat again leaves the north shore, and stands across from the stone mills, which are in the Prince Edward district, and form one of the features of the remarkable scenery of what is called the High Shore. This mountainous ridge, which descends perpendicularly to the water's edge, is still in forest, and, without doubt, this is the most romantic portion of the bay, whose waters are suddenly contracted to half their former dimensions, and glide on darkly and silently between these steep wood-crowned heights. There is a small lake upon the highest portion of this tableland, whose waters are led down the steep bank, and made to work a sawmill, which is certainly giving a very unromantic turn to them. But here, as in the States, the beautiful and the ideal are instantly converted into the real and the practical. This Lake of the Mountains is a favorite place for picnics and pleasure trips from Northport and Belleville. Here, the Sabbath school children come, once during the summer, to enjoy a ramble in the woods and spread their feast beneath the lordly oaks and maples that crown these heights. And the teetotalers marshal their bands of converts and hold their cold water festival beside the blue deep waters of this mysterious mountain lake. Strange stories are told of its unfathomable depth, of the quicksands that are found near it, and of its being supplied from the far-off inland ocean of Lake Huron. But like the cove in Thayendanegea, of which everybody in the neighborhood has heard something, but which nobody has seen, these accounts of the Lake of the Mountain rest only upon hearsay. The last rays of the sun still lingered on wood and stream when we arrived at Picton, which stands at the head of the Long Reach. The bay here is not wider than a broad river. The banks are very lofty and enclose the water in an oblong form, round which that part of the town which is near the shore is built. Picton is a very beautiful place, viewed from the deck of the steamer. Its situation is novel and imposing, and the number of pretty cottages that crown the steep ridge that rises almost perpendicularly from the water, peeping out from among fine orchards in full bearing, and trim gardens, give it quite a rural appearance. The steamboat enters this very bay by a very narrow passage, and, after delivering its freight and passengers at the wharf, backs out by the way she came in. There is no turning a large vessel round in this half-circle of deep blue water. Few spots in Canada would afford a finer subject for the artist's pencil than this small inland town, which is so seldom visited by strangers and tourists. The progress to wealth and importance made by this place is strikingly behind that of Belleville, which far exceeds it in size and population. 3 years ago, a very destructive fire consumed some of the principal buildings in the town, which has not yet recovered from its effects. Trade is not so brisk here as in Belleville, and the streets are dull and monotonous when compared with the stir and bustle of the latter, which, during the winter season, is crowded with sleighs from the country. The Bay of Quinte, during the winter, forms an excellent road to all the villages and towns on its shores. The people from the opposite side trade more with Belleville merchants than with those in their own district, and during the winter season, when the bay is completely frozen from the mouth of the Trent to Kingston, loaded teams are passing to and fro continually. It is the favorite afternoon drive of young and old, and when the wind, sweeping over such a broad surface of ice, is not too cold, and you are well wrapped up in furs and buffalo robes, a sleigh ride on the ice is very delightful. Not that I can ever wholly divest myself of a vague, indistinct sense of danger whilst rapidly gliding over this frozen mirror. I would rather be out on the bay in a gale of wind in a small boat than overtaken by a snowstorm on its frozen highways. Still, it is a pleasant sight of a bright, glowing winter day when the landscape glitters like a world composed of crystals, to watch the handsome sleighs, filled with well-dressed men and women, and drawn by spirited horses, dashing in all directions over this brilliant field of dazzling white. Night has fallen rapidly upon us since we left Picton in the distance. A darker shade is upon the woods, the hills, the waters, and by the time we approach Fredericksburg, it will be dark. This, too, is a very pretty place on the north side of the bay. Beautiful orchards and meadows skirt the water, and fine basswood and willow trees grow beside or bend over the waves. The green smooth meadows, out of which the black stumps rotted long ago, show noble groups of hickory and butternut, and sleek fat cows are reposing beneath them, or standing mid-leg in the small creek that wanders through them to pour its fairy tribute into the broad bay. We must leave the deck and return to the ladies' cabin, for the air from the water grows chilly, and the sense of seeing can no longer be gratified by remaining where we are. But if you open your eyes to see, and your ears to hear, all the strange sayings and doings of the odd people you meet in a steamboat, you will never lack amusement. The last time I went down to Kingston, there was a little girl in the cabin who rejoiced in the possession of a very large American doll, made so nearly to resemble an infant that at a distance it was easy to mistake it for one. To render the deception more striking, you could make it cry like a child by pressing your hand upon its body. A thin, long-laced farmer's wife came on board at the wharf we have just quitted, and it was amusing to watch her alternately gazing at the little girl and her doll. "Is that your baby, Sissy?"
"No, it's my doll."
"My, what a strange doll! Isn't that something uncommon? I took it for a real child. Look at its bare feet and hands and bald head. Well, I don't think it's exactly right to make a piece of wood look so like a human critter." The good-natured child put the doll into the woman's hands, who, happening to take it rather roughly, the wooden baby gave a loud squall. The woman's face expressed the utmost horror, and she dropped it on the floor as if it had been a hot coal. "Gracious goodness me! The thing's alive!" The little girl laughed heartily, and, taking up the discarded doll, explained to the woman the simple method employed to produce the sound. "Well, it do sound quite natural," said her astonished companion. "What will they find out next? It beats the railroad and the telegraph holler."
"Ah, but I saw a big doll that could speak when I was with Mama in New York," said the child with glistening eyes.
"A doll that could speak? You don't say. Oh, do tell." While the young lady described the automaton doll, it was amusing to watch the expressions of surprise, wonder, and curiosity that flitted over the woman's big, cadaverous face. She would have made a good study for a painter. A young relative of mine went down in the steamboat to be present at the provincial agricultural show that was held that year in the town of Buckville, on the St. Lawrence. It was the latter end of September. The weather was wet and stormy, and the boat loaded to the water's edge with cattle and passengers. The promenade decks were filled up with pigs, sheep, and oxen. Cows were looking sleepily in at the open doors of the ladies' cabin, and bulls were fastened on the upper deck. Such a motley group of bipeds and quadrupeds were never before huddled into such a narrow space, and amidst all this din and confusion, a Scotch piper was playing lustily on the bagpipes, greatly to the edification, I've no doubt, of himself and the crowd of animal life around him. The night came on very dark and stormy, and many of the women suffered as much from the pitching of the boat as if they had been at sea. The ladies' cabin was crowded to overflowing. Every sofa, bed, and chair was occupied, and my young friend, who did not feel any inconvenience from the storm, was greatly entertained by the dialogues carried on across the cabin by the women, who were reposing in their berths and lamenting over the rough water and their own sufferings in consequence. They were mostly the wives of farmers and respectable mechanics, and the language they used was neither very choice nor grammatical. "I say, Mrs. C., how be you?"
"I feel bad, anyhow," with a smothered groan.
"Have you been sick?"
"Not yet, but I feel as if I was going to."
"How's your head coming on, Mrs. N.?"
"It's just splitting, I thank you."
"Oh, how awful the boat do pitch," cries a third. "If she should sink, I'm afeard we shall all go to the bottom. And think of all those poor sheep and cattle."
"Well, of course, they'd have to go, too."
"Oh, my, I'll get up and be ready for a start, in case of the worst," cried a young girl.
Mrs. C., do give me something good out of your basket to keep up my spirits. Well, I will. Come over here, and you and I will have some talk. My basket's at the foot of my berth. You'll find in it a small bottle of brandy and some crulls. So up got several of the sick ladies, and kept up their spirits by eating cakes, chewing gum, and drinking cold brandy punch.
"Did Mrs. H. lose much in the fire last night?" said one.
"Oh, dear, yes. She lost all her clothes, and 3 large jars of preserves she made about a week ago, and sarse in accordance."
Note, a common Yankee phrase often used instead of the word proportion. There was an honest Yorkshire farmer and his wife on board, and when the morning at length broke through pouring rain and driving mist, and the port to which they were bound loomed through the haze, the women were very anxious to know if their husbands, who slept in the gentleman's cabin, were awake.
"They aren't stirring yet," said Mrs. G., "for I hear Isaac," meaning her husband, "breezing below,"
a most expressive term for very hard snoring. The same Isaac, when he came up to the ladies' cabin to take his wife on shore, complained in his broad Yorkshire dialect that he had been kept awake all night by a jovial gentleman who had been his fellow traveller in the cabin.
"We had a terrible noisy chap in cabin. They called him Mr. D., and said he were Mayor of Belleville, but I thought they were a-fooning. He wouldn't sleep hisself, nor let others sleep. He got Piper and put him up top at table and kept him playing all night."
One would think that friend Isaac had been haunted by the vision of the piper in his dreams, for certes the jovial buzzing of the pipes had not been able to drown the deep drones of his own nasal organ. A gentleman who was travelling in company with Sir A. told me an anecdote of him, and how he treated an impertinent fellow on board one of the lake boats, that greatly amused me. The state cabins in these large steamers open into the great saloon, and as they are often occupied by married people, each berth contains 2 beds, one placed above the other. Now it happens, when the boat is greatly crowded, that 2 passengers of the same sex are forced to occupy the same sleeping room. This was Sir A.'s case, and he was obliged, though very reluctantly, to share his sleeping apartment with a well-dressed American, but evidently a man of low standing from the familiarity of his manners and the bad grammar he used. In the morning it was necessary for one gentleman to rise before the other, as the space in front of their berths was too narrow to allow of more than one performing his ablutions at a time. Our Yankee made a fair start, and had nearly completed his toilet, when he suddenly spied a toothbrush and a box of tooth powder in the dressing case his companion had left open on the washstand. Upon these he pounced, and, having made a liberal use of them, flung them back into the case, and sat down upon the only chair the room contained, in order to gratify his curiosity by watching how his sleeping partner went through the same process. Sir A., greatly annoyed by the fellow's assurance, got out of bed, and placing the wash-basin on the floor, put his feet into the water, and commenced scrubbing his toenails with a desecrated toothbrush. Jonathan watched his movements for a few seconds in silent horror. At length, unable to contain himself, he exclaimed,
"Well, stranger, that's the dirtiest use I ever see a toothbrush put to, anyhow."
"I saw it put to a dirtier just now," said Sir A. very coolly. "I always use that brush for cleaning my toes."
The Yankee turned very green, and fled to the deck, but his nausea was not seasickness. The village of Napanee, on the north side of the bay, is situated on a very pretty river that bears the same name, Napanee in the Mohawk language signifying flower. The village is a mile back from the bay, and is not much seen from the water. There are a great many mills here, both grist and sawmills, from which circumstances it most likely derives its name. Amherst Island, which is some miles in extent, stands between Ontario and the Bay of Quinte, its upper and lower extremities forming the 2 straits that are called the Upper and Lower Gap, and the least breeze, which is not perceptible in the other portions of the bay, is felt here,
Passing through these gaps on a stormy day creates as great a nausea as a short chopping sea on the Atlantic, and I have seen both men and women retreat to their berths to avoid disagreeable consequences. Amherst Island is several miles in extent, and there are many good farms in high cultivation upon it, while its proximity on all sides to the water affords excellent sport to the angler and gunner, as wild ducks abound in this vicinity. Just after you pass the island and enter the lower gap, there are three very small islands in a direct line with each other that are known as the Three Brothers. A hermit has taken up his abode on the center one and built a very Robinson Crusoe-looking hut near the water, composed of round logs and large stones cemented together with clay. He gets his living by fishing and fowling, and you see his well-worn, weather-beaten boat drawn up in a little cove near his odd dwelling. I was very curious to obtain some particulars of the private history of this eccentric individual, but beyond what I have just related, my informants could tell me nothing, or why he had chosen this solitary abode in such an exposed situation, and so far apart from all the comforts of social life. The town of Bath is the last place of any note on this portion of the bay until you arrive at Kingston.
A morning song. The young wheat is springing, all tender and green, and the blackbird is singing the branches between. The leaves of the hawthorn have burst from their prison, and the bright eyes of morn on the earth have arisen. While sluggards are sleeping, oh, hasten with me! While the night mists are weeping soft showers on each tree, and nature is glowing beneath the warm beam the young day is throwing o'er mountain and stream. And the shy colt is bounding across the wide mead, and his wild hooves resounding increases his speed, now starting and crossing at each shadow he sees, now wantonly tossing his mane in the breeze. The skylark is shaking the dew from her wing, and the clover forsaking soars upwards to sing, in rapture outpouring her anthem of love, where angels adoring waft praises above. Shake dull sleep from your pillow, young dreamer, arise, on the leaves of the willow the dewdrop still lies, and the mavis is trilling his song from the brake, and with melody filling the wildwoods, awake!
End of chapter 9.